Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Professor Mark Gilbert. His European Integration of Political History was published in September by Roman and Littlefield. This book has had three lives, appearing first in 2003 with the title Surpassing Realism. Professor Gilbert updated it in 2011 as European Integration, a Concise History. Like its predecessors, this latest edition, now branded as a political history, is competing in the political science undergraduate market with textbooks like Desmond Dynan's Europe Recast, Wilfried Lotz's Building Europe, and the recently updated European Union Politics and Policies from John McCormick and Jonathan Olson. Mark Gilbert is resident professor of international history at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Bologna. Raised in Lincolnshire, he graduated in politics from Durham University and did his PhD in contemporary history at the University of Wales. Before joining SAIS 10 years ago, he taught at the Dickinson Liberal Arts College in Pennsylvania and then back in Europe at the universities of Bath and Trento. As well as European integration, this year his co-edited book Euroscepticisms was published, including a chapter by Mark on the intellectual origins of Brexit, Enoch Powell, Douglas Jay, and the British dissenting tradition. He's the associate editor of the Journal of Modern Italian Studies and is currently working on a political and social history of the founding of Italy's First Republic. This will be published by Rizzoli in Italy, by Penguin Worldwide, and by W.W. Norton in North America. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me, Tim.
As I said in the intro there, this book is clearly competing in the European studies textbook market, but to me it read like a classic narrative political history with a core argument, almost a plot arc. And by the way, not for nothing, it's a very digestible 280 pages of text. So apart from undergraduates, were you also aiming at a more casual or more general reader?
Yes, I was actually. I've always tried to write for the general reader. I think too many academics nowadays try to write for one another. I think the book is a general narrative history, as you rightly say, that doesn't assume knowledge on the part of the reader. I guess I'm writing for either the bright 21-year-old undergraduate or a young postgraduate who really wants to know more about European integration, or else, you know, a school teacher who wants to know more or a bank manager who wants to do more. I didn't think of the book in any way. I hope the book makes a contribution to the academic debate, but it's not intended for academics necessarily.
Yeah. Well, I'm speaking as someone who specializes in Europe and in his late 50s. I found it very useful too. It was a very good read.
Well, it might be a generational thing, because I'm in my late 50s too, and I suspect that things started to change in academia in the 90s and early 2000s. It became far more professionalized.
Yeah. Yeah. And what made you decide to update the book now?
Now, that's a very good question. And I think, despite the fact I've lived in Italy for a long time, I've remained very British. And I think if I had to identify one thing, it was Brexit. You know, Brexit really was the main impulse. Britain's leaving the European community was not the first time that a country has left the EU. Most people don't know that. Greenland and Algeria withdrew from the EC. But, you know, obviously Britain's leaving was of a different order of magnitude. And also, I think Brexit was the kind of thing that wasn't supposed to happen. I mean, I won't say that people thought that European integration was inevitable, but there is a kind of rhetorical inclination to suppose that that the EU had history on its side. I did myself. You know, if I look at the first edition of the book, Surpassing Realism, it's clearly, I wouldn't say bias, that's the wrong way, but the argument, the orientation of the argument is clearly more along the lines of the EC is a political entity who's on the right side of history, if you like. And as the different editions of the book have come out, I think I've just had to adjust that. And Brexit, I think, calls this sense of ongoing progress in European institutions into doubt. I mean, Britain is the second largest economy, arguably the most important geopolitical power in Europe, and for whatever reason, a very large number of its people didn't want to be in the EU anymore. I mean, it unquestionably changed the game, so to speak, and so I felt it was time for a new edition.
Well, you point out that you'd had long arguments with your brother about this at the beginning of the book.
Yes, well, actually, I think my brother will be delighted to hear this. He's been extraordinarily useful. I mean, he's almost the classic Brexit, you know, skilled worker, very patriotic, by no means anti-European, but completely convinced that European integration is taking away time-honored British liberties. And I have to say, in 2016, actually having a member of the part of a member of my family, which was so clearly in the pro-Brexit camp, was actually quite helpful, because I think within academia there was a certain tendency to assume that the referendum could only have one outcome. And, you know, it's really quite helpful to go to the pub in Lincolnshire sometime and hear what most people think.
How does he feel it's going so far?
I don't know. I think there's excuse me if I bring in an Italian word here, smarrimento. I think there is a sense of people, smarrimento means a sense of unease, not quite sure whether the right thing has been done, but nevertheless a definite commitment to staying the course. I thought the 2019 British general election was very interesting. If you think about it, we had a year, 2019, a quite extraordinary year from the point of view of British parliamentary politics, in which governments were defeated by record majorities but still didn't resign, in which the Prime Minister prorogued Parliament, in which the High Court found actions of the British government, if not illegal, then certainly unlawful. And yet at the end of that year, you know, Mr. Johnson won the election. He didn't get an absolute majority of the votes, but he did get a higher plurality of the vote than Tony Blair had in 1997. I think it's very difficult to say that the British didn't know what they wanted by the end of 2019, even if the country remained bitterly divided over the choice of the politically active majority.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the recent polling suggests that there's some regret going on, but you know, it's hard to judge. Mm-hmm. With the noise of the pandemic going on at the same time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned there that there is this core argument to your book, and you sort of touched on it there, I think, which is this idea that previous histories of the European Union you describe as being the last redoubt of Whig history, with the plot villains being Thatcher and de Gaulle, and you point out, I think rightly, that while you're not necessarily sympathetic to either of them. You simply say that their view of integration is different rather than wrong. Was that a key thing you wanted to get across?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think the official history, not the actual history done by historians of European integration, has always tended to give an idea of almost inexorable progress, that Europe was moving towards, more power for the supranational institutions of Europe, and that this was, broadly speaking, a good thing. That there was some that this process was being pushed along by people who were committed to the idea of a more federal Europe or a more supranational Europe, at any event, and was being opposed by people who were more narrowly nationalist, more determined to preserve the privileges and prerogatives of the nation states. And De Gaulle and Thatcher are the two star cases in that. Now, I think if you look at the historiography, just looking at the two cases of de Gaulle, and I think actually Thatcher too, it's very hard to sustain this. Whig history, the Tories made a contribution too, so to speak. If you look at de Gaulle, he had a different view of European integration from Jean Monnet or Hallstein or Federalist supporters of European unity, of course. But I think most serious historians recognize that the contribution that de Gaulle made simply by insisting on France's prerogatives, simply by insisting on certain institutional solutions, was enormous. I mean, one French historian who I esteem very much, a guy called Laurent Waluzy, regards de Gaulle as a founding father of the EC. Now, that's not something you would have heard even 20 years ago. Mrs. Thatcher is being reevaluated too. I think if you look, for example, at the notorious Bruges speech in September 1988, which is claimed both by keen supporters of European federalism and by Eurosceptics in Britain to be the start of the Eurosceptic movement. I think if you look at that speech, it's more a defense of the EC as it always had been, in opposition to the EC that Jacques Delors wanted to construct. That doesn't make her, therefore, automatically Eurosceptic, so much as skeptical of what Jacques Delors wanted. And I think that's the kind of thing historians do. I think, most of the serious historiography on European integration now is definitely moving in the direction of saying, there was this thing called the European Community, and then under the pressure of globalization, the end of the Cold War and so forth, it shifted into something else called the European Union. And it's not correct to think of the European Union today as somehow being the logical and lineal descendant of the Schuman Plan. No? And that's what we mean by Whig history. When we talk of Whig history, which, like most historians, I'm critical of, that's what the Whig history approach is. And I don't think most historians can reasonably support it.
It's funny what you say about the Bruges speech. I interviewed Stephen Wall a couple of weeks ago, and he mentions in his book that when he was working for Tony Blair, Blair asked him to bring a copy of the Bruges speech to him. And after he read it, he said he agreed with pretty much every word. It was it was a constructive approach to, as you say, to differentiation between the Delors and Thatcher version vision rather than destructive.
No, I think it's a very interesting case. I mean, in effect, in that book, what Mrs. Thatcher was saying, I mean, it would have been agreed with by practically every German and Dutch and many Italian politicians throughout the post-war period. And it was a criticism of the radical and rapid acceleration that was going on within the European community at the time. And what she saw as being the creation, it's the famous soundbite of a European superstate, which would roll back what she regarded as her fundamental reforms to the British economy and would take steps towards supranationalism that she wasn't prepared to countenance. I think one has to acknowledge that political decisions come out of an interplay. It comes out of contrast. There are contrasts. Some people think one thing, other people think another thing. People argue over them. And what tends to come out is very often something in the middle, or else sometimes people are defeated. Mrs. Thatcher was defeated over Europe. I mean, quite literally, I think it is the biggest contributive cause to her downfall, which, of course, was also one of the main reasons why Euroscepticism became so strong in Britain, because so many of the people who are Eurosceptics were also passionate Thatcherites who felt that the bulk of their, of her own party had actually betrayed her.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I mean, in your chapter on Thatcher, you point out something that I think is very significant, which is about the Single European Act. That you know, as you say, that during her career in Number 10, she was resistant to things, but she was also proactive. And I've got a couple of quotes from the book here where you say the Single European Act was, quote, the most significant step towards greater integration in Europe since the signature of the EEC Treaty in 1957. And, quote, the Single European Act may have been a lower common denominator agreement, but the common denominator was a high one. Do you feel that the Single European Act and the creation of the internal market is an underestimated feature of European integration?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, as I say, most of the new historiography would agree with that. I actually think it started in the 1970s. 1970s in the used to be regarded as a kind of barren period, if only because there were no particular innovations institutionally within the European community. But in fact, I think most people realize that in the 1970s, the EC didn't collapse. The European Council was created. The EC took an increasing global role in trade development issues. The treaties were constitutionalized. The Mediterranean democratized and probably wouldn't have democratized without the EU, EC's support and so forth. But nevertheless, it remains true that if you were in one of the member states in 1983, in terms of single movement, the movement of goods, the movement of individuals, recognition of qualifications and so forth, things really hadn't changed that much since 1963. No, I first moved to Italy in 19. Excuse me if I give you a long answer on this, but I think it's quite good to give a concrete illustration. I first moved to Italy at the end of 1986, and when my wife and I wanted to go to visit my family in England, we had to get in the car and drive to the Brennero, where the Austrians checked our passport. And we had to use shillings until we got to Kufstein, where the Germans collected our passport. Then we drove all the way across Europe and to the French border, where the French checked our passports. And of course, we've been using different currencies all along. Then we drove to Luxembourg, where at least at the beginning of this period, the Luxembourgeois checked your passport incredibly. You drove across Luxembourg for half an hour, entered Belgium, where the Belgians didn't check your passport. I don't know why. Maybe they just felt it was really rather silly. Then you got to, then we used to take the car as far as Zeebrugge and catch the ferry to Felixstowe, where the British check your passport and you had to use pounds. I mean, if you think about it, apart from the British end of that, all of that was changed between 1986 and 1992. 1993, January 92, the 1992 initiative, which was started by the Single European Act and brought ahead and accentuated by the different decisions taken by the European Council on the advice of the Delors Commission between 87 and 1992. And the interesting thing about this, paradoxically, of course, is that so much of that was actually a Thatcherite in inspiration. Mrs. Thatcher wanted the single market. She was prepared to even give up Britain's veto on literally hundreds of different line items that she once upon a time could theoretically have vetoed in order to get the single market. Mrs. Thatcher, from that point of view, took a very strong position on the centrality of the Single European Act. She just didn't want a super state. She said somewhere, I can't remember where, maybe in the memoirs, she says somewhere the Single European Act was kind of clearing the ground, but she didn't want to see a super state erected on top of it. She saw it as being an open space in which countries compete. Now, you know, you might say that's wrong, but it's not obviously one is obviously more European or pro-European or anti-European than another. And I think she just had very much a... She definitely, in the case of Margaret Thatcher, there was a preference for an intergovernmental, market-based solution to Europe's future. In the case of Delors, there was definitely a more centralizing, perhaps more administratively centered. I suppose, in a way, it's the difference between the British and the French approach to political economy. I wouldn't like to put that too far, but I think there's some truth to that.
It certainly wouldn't have happened as quickly, but do you think Europe would have got to an internal market even without her and without Arthur Cofield? I mean, is it something Delors would have cottoned on to in any case in order to get to his ultimate target, do you think?
Yeah, I think it was probably necessary now, because you had the enormous debate about eurosclerosis. You had the ongoing process of globalization, what we call globalization now. We take it for granted, but of course it was starting in the 1980s. The pressure on the need for Europe to ensure that its domestic market was larger in the face of growing competition. I think it would have taken longer, but it would have happened, I'm sure.
Yeah, coming back to De Gaulle, the other thing that I got a better understanding of from reading this book was the intellectual origins of the kind of European policy carried out by people like Chirac and Sarkozy. Because I was always confused by the mixture of what appeared occasionally to be a sort of federalist ambition, but then stepping back on core issues. And your description of de Gaulle's thinking around that put that sort of Gaullist tradition of European policy making into much more context. It made it more understandable, I think.
Yeah, no, I think de Gaulle's vision of Europe was a way of reinforcing France. And France would have been, you know, primus inter pares as when it came to making the big political decisions. I think there's always been the French traditionally, you see it with Macron today, have always wanted a Europe which speaks with one voice, as long as that one voice in foreign affairs, perhaps even in defence, on the big questions of identity, provided that vision doesn't deviate too far from what the French wanted to say. And I think Germany has always been a balancing a partner in that. The Germans have typically tended to support greater European self-affirmation. They've tended to allow, to some extent, the German lead until the last 20 years or so, where it's really become impossible because Germany has just become, relatively speaking, so much more important. I think the countries who don't like this are paradoxically the smaller countries. And I think the Netherlands in particular is a country which is always very uneasy about Franco-German decisions being taken for what Europe as a whole should be doing. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Dutch were so disappointed by Brexit and by Britain's attitude over the last 10, 15 years towards European integration.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they've lost the British now, and that potential counterweight never really appeared to work. But are you surprised? I'm putting words in your mouth in a way, because it's something that's always surprised me, but by the inability of the medium-sized countries and the smaller countries basically to form a counterweight bloc themselves. I mean, you're seeing the Dutch attempting to do this with this Hanseatic League and so on, but it never seems to have the coherence that is necessary to achieve what they want, even most recently with the next generation EU budget line.
No, I think that's an interesting question. And to be honest, I'm not sure I've got an answer to that. I've not really thought about that, but except in the context of Italy, about which I know quite a lot. Italy has never punched its weight either.
No.
and one says that. One's immediate response is, well, you know, Italy, political system, bit chaotic, etc. Except on Europe, they've been remarkably consistent in their views about what they want. And Italy is, or has been, for most of the period of European integration, a successful economy. It's been struggling the last 10 years, but it's always been a very successful economy. Italy has some very good diplomats. Nevertheless, it never really broke into the Franco-German club and exercised a weight comparable even to Britain's, or in some ways even the Dutch. I think there's no doubt that Paris and Berlin now, Bonn before, have tended to regard themselves as being the main, progenitors of any new initiative in Europe. I don't want to say the EU today and the EEC before it was a Franco-German club. That would be radically mistaken. In fact, one of the things that, you know, we talk of a democratic deficit in Europe, but one of the things actually which the European community brought to Europe was the fact that it brought greater democracy between the countries of Europe. Nevertheless, it remains true that the central innovations in the history of the European community never got anywhere unless they had joint Franco-German support. It really is the key variable here.
Yeah. And the other thing, apart from that, is, and you have this sentence where you say the European Economic Community rose phoenix-like from the European Defence Community's humiliating failure. Do you think this is a typical pattern of the EU's development? The Lisbon Treaty coming out of the Constitutional Treaty failure, the ESM and the Fiscal Compact coming out of the debt crisis, and now this huge next generation EU budgetary package coming out of the pandemic. Does it require not only Franco-German alliance, it requires crisis to be for the EU to be creative?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have said that. I mean, I could add to your list probably the biggest single case of all this, which is the creation of the European Council in 1974 as a response to the failure of the communities in the early 1970s. I don't think there's any doubt that the European project is extremely resilient. And that's because the big European countries have invested so much in it. That, of course, is one of the reasons why Brexit is such an interesting development. But the other countries of Europe have, or at least their traditional political classes, let's put it that way, have invested so much in the European project. It leads them always, I think, to seek European solutions for temporary problems. And that is a source of resilience and strength for the EU.
Do you not find it quite occasionally also to be something that they hide behind? I mean, I think most recently of the German response to the poisoning of Navalny, when they were asked for a response, they always said, we need to go through the European Union in the hope that the European Union will put brakes on it.
Yeah. No, I think there's an element of truth of that, isn't it? Yes. I'm to think of a long answer to that. The European Union, I think, is an extremely useful instrument of policy for all the European countries. And it's also true it's something that they can hide behind, yes. Mm. Although, incidentally, you just add something to that. I mean, I think a lot of countries in Europe are far more skeptical about greater powers for the European Union than they say in their public pronouncements. And now Britain is no longer part of the EU. They are going to find themselves in a difficult position because they were able to hide behind Britain.
Yes, God. I mean, the one that always jumps out to me is the financial transactions tax that they got enhanced cooperation to negotiate that from 2013, and they've still got nowhere with it. But that's on the sort of negative side. On the positive side, in terms of European Union's ability to integrate, you mentioned this term functional integration in the book, and it seems to me that that's been the most effective glue for the European Union. It's the thing that tends to achieve progress. I mean, most obviously, initially with the coal and steel community, the nuclear community, most recently with banking union. What do you think could be next? I mean, they're going through a capital markets union process at the moment. Do you think there could be something with healthcare following the pandemic, or what do you think?
I don't know. Historians are normally very wary about making predictions of the future. I mean, John Lewis Gaddis, the famous Cold War historian, always contrasts historians, says that historians do retrocasting, not forecast, like political scientists and economists, but we do have the satisfaction of more often being right. My own feeling is that the one area where the EU has simply got to get its act together and have common policies is foreign policy. The European Union, you know, we're looking at the American election results just now. It's still not clear who's going to win, but the European Union is out in the world with the United States, which is much less pro-European than it has been for an awful long time. You have the enormous demographic growth and political troubles of Africa. You've got Russia on the doorstep. You've got Turkey practically urging Europe's Muslims to react against their oppressed status. There's simply no doubt that Europe needs to develop a common foreign policy identity which is stronger than it currently has. Now, whether it's capable of doing that is beyond my competence to say. But I think that's the area where, if there is one area where the EU needs to start thinking very seriously about. I think President Macron, when was it? November 2019, which he went so far as to say NATO was brain dead, and then went on to argue that in favour of the need for a stronger defence and foreign policy identity for the EU. I mean, I don't know if he's right to say NATO's brain dead, but I think he was right to identify Europe's key structural problem at the moment as being foreign policy, because the challenges that Europe is facing are so enormous that it needs to have a clear sense of what it wants to do collectively, if it can. And it's not obvious that it can agree on that.
I mean, your history shows the repeated failures to create a meaningful defence identity beyond NATO. Mm-hmm. Do you think the problem there is simply that as long as NATO exists, a real meaningful defence identity isn't required beyond what is required to protect the Schengen area, you know, the Frontex, Coast Guards and so on, that there isn't actually a need for the European Union to project power?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no, I think, is the answer to that. Because you run into questions of ideas, of beliefs, ideas, sense of identity and belonging. There are a great many people in the EU who are passionately Atlanticist. You know, the Dutch spring to mind in this respect, the British did. You have countries like Poland and the Baltic states who, frankly, do not believe their European neighbours are a guarantee against Russia in the same way as the United States do. And also, I think you have another more cultural issue at work, which is, you know, for so many European states, the European Union is supposed to be about not being a great power. It was the thing that people were supposed to have turned their back on. No, I think of Germany and Italy, both of which have constitutional provisions against ever going to war. I think that's why when the European Union tried to develop a foreign policy identity, it was always in terms of, you know, the neighborhood policies, the spreading European values, projecting soft power rather than hard power. I find it very hard to believe that the European Union can carry on like that. That's just my opinion, but I'm a historian and not an expert on modern security policy, but I find it very hard to imagine that the EU can carry on without a real foreign and defence policy in the future. Mm. And this has been one area in which really extraordinarily little progress towards any kind of supranationalism has ever been made. I mean, you can bring out things like the Iran deal, you can bring out things like development policy and so forth. But on the key issues of defence and what you might describe as global strategy, Europe has always tried to stay as close to the United States as the United States would let it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, to finish off, since this is a podcast series about books, I have two final questions about books. You gave an interview to someone at SAIS 10 years ago where you said your two favorite books were War and Peace and Homage to Catalonia, but you couldn't make up your mind. Have you made up your mind over the last decade?
What a nice question. I didn't expect that. No, I haven't. I don't know. The idea of Orwell, that marvelous picture, Orwell, I think unconsciously, I don't think he was trying to consciously draw a picture of honest George in the intricacies of Spanish politics, risking his life, trying to cut somebody, pretending that he's an incompetent soldier, where if you read between the lines, he quite clearly was a very competent soldier indeed, striving for honesty, striving for... to me, it remains one of the greatest pieces of reportage that's ever been written. I mean, I've got a Spanish friend who says exactly the same thing. And the other thing, War and Peace. I actually teach a course called Peace and War, and I sometimes scare my students by saying, you've all got to read this book. Of course, it's not on the reading list, but you've all got to read it because so many of them haven't. It seems to me to be something I find, sad, verging on tragic, that people don't sit down and read these great classics of the 19th century any longer. War and Peace, I think you just get lost in it. I don't know what your reaction was when you read it for the first time, but for me, you're just there and you're lost in, I mean, the guy somehow manages to create a real history and you feel like you're an observer in the middle of it. I think it's a wonderful book.
Hmm. Well, my second question is a bit more prosaic, which is what book on Europe, on the area that you cover, have you read in recent years that you would particularly recommend?
I think two. Luke van Middelaar's book. Luke van Middelaar was an advisor to Van Rompuy, and he has written an extremely interesting book on the European crisis called Alarums and Excursions. I'd really recommend you to interview him and get him talking about that. Alarums and Excursions, Improvising Thought Politics on the European Stage, which is about the role of the European Council and how the European Union has been able to cope with some of the crises of the last 10, 15 years as a result of the European Council. And the other book is just appeared in 2020 by a German writer, Kieran Klaus Patel, called Project Europe, A History. That's the English translation published by Cambridge University Press, which is, I think, it's one of those books which will change or at any rate confirm the shift in paradigm which has gone on in the historiography. Excuse the jargon, but it really is a way of saying, right, let's take stock of the history of the European community. He does it in not via narrative history so much as by looking at different aspects of the development of the European community up to the case, up to Maastricht. And is really treating the development of the European community differently from and separate to the subsequent creation of the European Union. I think those two books really stand out, I think, for the sophistication, but also the readability that they have in bringing European integration to life and raising important questions for us to think about.
Right. Well, today, Mark Gilbert and I have been discussing his European Integration, A Political History, published in September by Roman and Littlefield. Mark, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast.
Well, thank you, Tim. It was great.